I need a minute. We're continuing our series on the Sermon on the Mount. And when we look at today's scripture from the Sermon on the Mount, we can see where part of this fascination that people have with the law comes in. In this section of the Sermon on the Mount, we hear Jesus talking first about the law, the commandments, the rules. We hear the rabbi, the teacher, Jesus, seeming to advocate business as usual. Here's what he says. We're in the Gospel of Matthew, the 5th chapter, beginning with the 17th verse. "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." So there we go. We've heard that before. It's the same thing we've heard since Moses came down from the mountain carrying those tablets. But there is something new here. Jesus says, "I have not come to abolish the laws or the teachings of the prophets, but to fulfill them." Now that's an odd word, fulfill. If Jesus did not come to do away with the law, then I would expect a word like enforce. "I have come to enforce the law." Wouldn't you? "I have not come to abolish the law," Jesus says, "not even the smallest letter of it, but to enforce it." I would expect something like enforce. That's what I'd expect, but it isn't what we get. We get Jesus' promise to fulfill the law. So, what does that mean? What is this fulfillment of the law about? Studying the word suggests that Jesus said, "I have come to complete the law," or "I have come to perfect the law." You could say that Jesus came to change the rule of God into the reign of grace. The letter of the law, the words of the law are the same, but now the intent of the law is very different. Might look like this: "Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit false witness against thy neighbor." These rules are still in the books. They still form the basis of the social contract that undergirds our civilization. These are the rules that make up our social contract. To avoid the kind of mayhem that would happen without social contracts, the great thinker Thomas Hobbes says, "Free people contract with each other to establish political, civil society through a social contract in which they all gain security in return for subjecting themselves to a sovereign power." So when we adhere to the law, then when we become a party to the social contract, we create civilization. But I have a newsflash for you this morning. Jesus did not come so that we would act civilized. Jesus did not come to idealize or idolize or enforce the laws that are society's contracts. Jesus came to do something remarkably different. He came to fulfill, to perfect the law not so that we can behave civilly toward one another, but so that we can love each other. So that we can live as people who will go the extra mile for each other, who will not just respect each other's rights, but love our neighbors as ourselves. Jesus came to be the new covenant. Jesus came to realize, which means to make real, not civilization, but beloved community. The new covenant, Jesus Christ, fulfills the laws, perfects the social contracts, and transforms them into covenants. Let's look at how this happens. Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said to people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." In other words, you can live civilly by honoring the social contract that says, "I will not murder." But if you want to live abundantly, compassionately, in covenant, you will take the radical step of not letting your anger injure anyone. And you will not steal another's life, nor will you steal their reputation. Living in covenant is as radical as Jesus himself. You can earn praises from society by honoring social contracts, but you can't change the world. You can't even change yourself. Jesus came to call us to live in covenant, no exemptions, no exceptions, to live in covenant in our homes. Are you living by that social contract that says, "Till death do us part," but ignoring the life-giving covenants, the beyond the getting alongs, like, "Honey, you're looking tired. I'll cook and clean up." Sometimes covenants are 80-20. Are you honoring your part of the contract to provide necessities for your adopted children or stepchildren? Are you providing the necessities, which is part of your contract? Or are you honoring the covenant that would have you saying to your stepchild, to your adopted child, for no reason, "It was a great day, the day you came into my life"? Are you living in covenant in your place of work? Are you making good on your contract, punching the clock, giving an honest day's work for an honest day's pay? Or are you in covenant with your workplace, looking around for someone to encourage rather than someone to blame? Thinking about what your team or division might do if you stopped worrying about who gets the credit for what gets done? Do you show up at a meeting occasionally with a box of donuts or a vegetable tray, just as a way of saying, "I'm glad to be part of this"? To live in covenant with our churches. How are you really living in relation to your church? Have you entered a contract in which you offer a minimum commitment and expect a certain return? Do you expect a certain style of music? Do you expect the preacher to focus on or maybe avoid particular sermon topics? Or are you living in covenant, praying before you come to the service that you hear just the right word, or that even if you don't, the right words speak to someone who need them more than you do? Do you relinquish your preferences in hopes that our worship pleases God? Now, I've asked you these questions before. I've preached about it ad nauseum, I'm sure. But today, I want to take a different approach. I want to talk less about you who are here and what your relationship is with the church. And I want to talk more about the people who are not here. And why are they not here? And what would it take to have a covenant relationship with them? Here are some of the people who are not in church. One, those whose lives are overly full. It's almost a shock that any of us are here, right? Because the ones whose lives are overly full are not here. My own family is a good example. From July through November, my son-in-law's job as a football coach means he works 7 days a week. On that rare Sunday when he has an open week and is home on Sunday morning, our grandkids, all of them or part of them, stay home with Daddy. And nothing could make me happier. His love for them, their love for him. Never do I think they should all be at church. Those of you who work, 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 and cannot make the choice to not work on Saturday night or not to attend to your aging parents' needs on Sunday, your only day off, may seriously need to steal a couple of hours on Sunday morning to work out, to reconnect with friends, to stay in your PJs. And this doesn't even take into account our kids' schedules, Sunday soccer games and friends' birthday parties and 4-H and dance. Two, the people who are not here, those who want something better for their children. It isn't so hard to stay in the Baptist Church or the United Methodist Church and practice cafeteria Christianity. Take what you like and leave the rest. But when your own children start asking questions about everything, can girls be astronauts, Daddy? Of course. Can girls build computers, Daddy? You bet. And be veterinarians? Oh, you'd make a great one, sweetheart. And girls can be preachers, too. Well, no, baby, they can't. Some people have left the church because their children are asking too many questions that can't be answered without great discomfort. Who else is not in church? Those who don't want to answer questions about where they've been. I'm not even going to say anything about that, because... Four. There's a new term. Have you heard it? Ex-vangelicals. We've heard about them for years. They are largely leaving the churches because the church is hateful to LGBTQ people. But their friends are queer. And their children, whom they are refusing to abandon because the church, their pastors and elders told them to, their own children are queer and questioning. But they're also leaving the evangelical churches because old standbys like abstinence only and purity promises are failing spectacularly. Not because they're inherently bad or wrong, but because they're no match for hormones and falling in love. And how much more Texas heat do they really need before their minds open up to the reality of climate change? But the church isn't opening up with them. And ultimately, does it feel good to be part of the in-group and define yourselves only by describing who is out of the group? Those people aren't in church. And then there are the nones, and I don't mean the, but the N-O-N-E-S's. You've heard this. The ones who don't call any denomination or congregation home. But I'll get back to that. First, let me tell you how much it's been killing me that none of those people I just talked about are coming to church. Now, it's not killing me that individually they're not coming to church. I can understand why all these people individually are not coming to church. But as a group, as a big group, it's starting to have some pretty dire consequences. Attendance, way down. And you know about the offering, so dang it, why are people not prioritizing church? I have started to do the mature thing. I have started to blame God. God, where are you in this? Where is your spirit moving? Don't we love you because you first loved us? Are you going to let this church fail? Why aren't you drawing the people to yourself? Why aren't you drawing the people to church? Over the last few weeks, I've been struck by a new thought. I have always asked people to live in covenant relationships with the church. But in return, I think we've been offering them a contract relationship with the church. I've been making plenty of room for the realities of their lives. The church is here for the people with their busy, busy lives. For those who want a truer, more faithful experience for their children than what their current church offers, we're here. This church is here for the ex-evangelicals and for the nuns. Three full hours on Sunday morning, like clockwork. And we will have beautiful music. Church music, mostly, hymns, mostly, some Broadway. But it's really, really good. You heard it. And we'll offer community prayers, and they are beautiful and full of meaning. And I'll preach, or someone else will preach. Not many opportunities for you to talk, sorry. Or ask your questions, sorry. Unless you want to email me. And some of you do, and I promise I'll respond. Oh, and your deacons are on call. We'll hook you up. And if you can't find God in that, I have been disappointed in God for not bringing the people to church. My vision has been too narrow, not just now, but for a very long time. If we build it, they will come, right? If we build it and God will do God's part, more will come. During the 3-hour window on Sunday morning, God has not stopped being God. Jesus has not stopped calling disciples, but I have stepped in with a calling contract more restrictive than Verizon or T-Mobile or Spectrum ever thought of being. We as a church cannot be all things to all people. And I, as your leader, can't lead certain types of worship experience that are beyond my own experience, beyond my abilities, but we can certainly offer more. I need you to stay tuned. I need you to tune in. I need you to promise me that you will read news and notes this morning and not just click on it so it'll show up in our thing and you can let it go. We are accepting the error of if we build it, they will come, and we are adopting the invitation of if we build it with them, they will come and stay. I don't have enough time to go into this in greater depth today, but please, please do read news and notes. I'll lay out a lot more of the pieces of the plan. For now, let me say that we are planning to bring new opportunities, new energy, new ideas, new people to Uprising. This Sunday morning experience of Bible study and worship and salt will not go away, but it will become part of the covenant rather than the whole contract. I'm going to leave you this morning with an excerpt from an article written by Perry Bacon Jr. The title of his article was, "I Left the Church and Now Long for a Church for the Nuns." God is still speaking. Jesus is still calling. Don't doubt it. Perry Bacon grew up in the church, and he left the church for many of the reasons I've already described to you this morning. Here's what he has to say about his experience of leaving the church. "The Saturday farmers market in my neighborhood and a weekly happy hour of Louisville area journalists provide some of what church once did for me." Let me see what. "Consistent gatherings of people with some shared values and interest. I've made new friends through both, and there are plenty of other groups and clubs I could join. But none of those gatherings provide singing, sermons, and solidarity all at once. My upbringing makes me particularly inclined to see a church-sized hole in America's life. But as a middle-aged American in the middle of the country, I don't think that hole is just in my imagination." Listen to this now. "Kids need places to learn values like forgiveness, while schools focus on math and reading. Young adults need places to meet a potential spouse. Adults with children need places to meet with other parents and some free babysitting on the weekends." Yeah. "Retirees need places to build new relationships as their friends and spouses pass away." Yeah, we're doing pretty well at that one. "Our society needs places that integrate people across class and racial lines. Newly woke Americans need places to get practical weekly advice about how to live out the inclusive, anti-racist values that they committed to during the Trump years. The anti-Trump majority in the United States needs institutions that are separate from the official Democratic Party, which is unsurprisingly more focused on winning elections than in creating a sense of community for left-leaning people. There are lots of organizations trying to address those needs, but strong churches could address them all. Strong churches could address them all. That isn't some fantasy or nostalgia. Many Americans, including me, he says, were once part of churches that were essential parts of our lives. It's strange to me that America, particularly its left-leaning cohort, is abandoning this institution as opposed to reinventing it to align with our 2023 values. Reinventing. Stay tuned.